another edition of In and Out of Sports in the Coach's Corner with yours truly, Coach Butch McAdams. And this show is sponsored by Horton's Funeral Services, Dr. Edward T. Buford, and the Athletic Republic. And always, always what makes this show possible is our partners at the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com. And that means my friend, my producer, golfer extraordinaire, Rick Hampton Sr. Well, folks, we have a very interesting guest in the Coach's Corner this evening. I tell you, she's a poet, a writer, a lecturer, a policy advocate, president of the Morningstar Institute, and since the 60s, she's worked on getting the sports teams to drop mascots that promote negative stereotypes. And I could go on and on. I was presented in 2014, I believe, with the prestigious president medal. And boy, you know, she's just awesome. She is Suzanne Harjo. And Suzanne, welcome to the Coach's Corner. And was that 2004 or 14 when you...
14, yes. 14, President Obama yeah, was the one
that's
who
right,
awarded
the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Okay. But let's start off. And, I mean, you have been a Martin Luther King, a Jesse Jackson, in terms of causes for your people, Native Americans. But I want to start off talking about some of the negative stereotypes and images that have portrayed our indigenous people. Growing up, as a child, you know, they were portrayed as savages, less than human, and you know, the same as African Americans. So, you know what? It's up to us to tell our story, not let someone else to tell the story, but to tell our story. Please, tonight, in the next 60 minutes or so, tell your story.
Well, I'm from Oklahoma. I'm from El Reno. I was born in El Reno, Oklahoma, which is about 25 miles due west of Oklahoma City, and it's within the exterior boundaries of the Cheyenne and Arapaho Treaty Reservation boundaries. And I'm Cheyenne on my mother's side, and my dad was Muscogee Creek, and I grew up in part with his folks on a farm between Mulde and Beggs, and that's south of Tulsa. Mm-hmm. So small town Oklahoma, country Oklahoma, and Muscogee and Cheyenne. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty much what I knew. My dad was in the military, was in the Army, and my mother traveled with him everywhere. And they took me and my brothers, two younger ones, 5 years younger than I, twins. And we grew up with our grandparents, but our parents took us to two great places. They were stationed in Hawaii, and they took us there, so that was great. And then they took us to Italy, to Napoli, where Dad was stationed with Allied Forces Southern Europe, with NATO. And so we really had the best of all worlds. We grew up grandparents who knew their stuff as far as our Native history and how to get along in the world as Native people. And we grew up with our parents in these wonderful places where we understood a lot about respect for other people's cultures, other nations, other other people's ways, other people's religions and dances and songs and languages. So that was invaluable. Mm-hmm. And when I was growing up in Italy, it was different from the times when we would go into the city in Oklahoma, dangerous for us because we would get yelled at or spat at or beat up because we were Native. And when I grew up, I'm 75 now, so when I grew up, it was in the era of the signs that said no Indians or dogs allowed. And my mother remembers in El Reno as well, growing up when she was a girl, the sign that said Indians and coloreds off the street by sundown.
Wow.
And
yeah.
She said the first thing she thought was, I thought we were coloreds. That was really interesting. And the hated peoples in Oklahoma were Indians, blacks, and Jews. And that's sort of the way it was for a long, long time, may still be in certain quarters in Oklahoma.
And let's talk about your family history. I see where your great-grandfather was a chief, and his name was Chief Bull Bear.
Yes.
Yeah,
he was kind of a famous chief. He was the head of the Cheyenne Resistance as the leader of the Dogmen Society at a time when the Dogmen families comprised about half of the Cheyenne Nation. And he and two other men were the leaders of that society in the late 1800s. And he was also a peace chief on the Council of 44. And he signed a treaty that created the reservation in Indian Territory, now is the territory of the in Oklahoma, of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes in Oklahoma. So my citizenship is that I'm a Cheyenne citizen of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes, but I'm also culturally Muscogee from the ceremonial ground Nuyaka in eastern Oklahoma.
I was going to say, you had said something that was quite interesting at the beginning when you said that you were reared to respect different cultures, different tribes, different ethnicities. For our listening audience and for me, talk about how there are differences between the various tribes of Native Americans where, you know, due to ignorance, some people will just see a Native American and think that they're all the same, where they're not. And so can you educate us this evening on the differences as it varies from tribe to tribe?
Well, you need to start with language. The Cheyennes, for example, are part of the Algonquin language stock, and that language is shared by the Arapahos, the Anishinaabe, the Penobscots, Passamaquoddies, Mashantucket Pequots. So that gives you sort of a clue that the Cheyennes were first in what's now the Northeast United States, up there around Nova Scotia and around the Passamaquoddies and Penobscots in what's now Maine.
Mm-hmm.
So they, that's the common linguistic stock. They're different languages, but they have a lot in common, structure, grammar, a lot of vocabulary in common, and the pronunciations are pretty much the same. but they are distinct languages. Muscogee, on the other hand, the Muscogee Creek language, languages are as different as the 200 or so Native nations and tribal towns that comprised the Muscogee Confederacy at one point. So that would include everything from Seminole and Choctaw and Chickasaw and Alabama and Coushatta, lots and lots of Miccosukee, lots of different Native nations now and in the past. And Andrew Jackson force-marched, he teamed up with Georgia, with the white racist in Georgia, and the white supremacist who would comprise Alabama and Mississippi, to try to move Native peoples out of those states and into Indian territory, and teamed up with the white racist in Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, those states up there, Ohio, to try to move the Potawatomi and Ottawa and other peoples out of those states, Sac and Fox, and try to funnel them into Indian territory. And then, of course, once they found black gold in Indian territory, then the white people wanted it and tried to push the Native people out of the way and had a lot of skullduggery going on and lots of Native people murdered by wildcatters and white men who were trying to, who would marry Native women, and all of a sudden the Native woman might be at the bottom of the root cellar with a broken neck, and they'd say, oh, it was an accident, and then that white man would inherit their land. So there was lots of that stuff going on. Go ahead.
Yeah. At what point did you decide that you wanted to be an activist? Because I've always said to be an activist, to be outspoken, is a great thing. It's a marvelous thing. But it's not for everyone. And look, you could have gone on about your career, made a lot of money, become famous, but you chose to be an activist. Why?
Well, that's how I was raised. I was infused with knowledge and infused with history and rehearsed. It wasn't just that I heard history or that I heard culture. I was a participant. I was active in it. And then I would have to tell that in my own words or tell it in my own time and would be corrected on it, say, well, that's not exactly right. This is the way it was, or this is the way it was. And you learn by teaching others and being corrected about things. And it could be a small thing, could be a large thing, but after a while, you're very clear about the history, about how it is you're articulating a certain matter, and it's so while you're building this knowledge base, while others are giving you that knowledge, they're also giving you tools to understand how to debate, how to argue, how to present, how to convince. In Oklahoma, as violent a place as it was, my dad and uncles also taught me how to defend myself, and so I knew how to fight. I didn't like it, but I knew how to fight.
So I like that.
That helped.
That's right. That's right.
You know, we didn't carry guns, but we knew our way around rifles. And, you know, you shoot your breakfast and you go out and hunt a deer. And go out and fish, and you're farming and doing all these things that you knew how to sustain yourself. You knew what it took to have a lot of people living together on a farm and being able to feed everyone, and that everyone has a role, everyone has an important position, and everyone has to live up to their position. They have to do the best job they possibly can, or the whole body of people will suffer. So that there were all those life lessons, in addition to knowing what crop you plant next to what crop, and that this kind of plant loves that kind of plant, this kind of food loves to grow next to that kind of food, poison, what's not, what you don't go near, what you always cultivate, what kind of roots to dig for, what kind of fish you never want to eat, what kind of fish you do. These are things that you learn growing up. And so I had a remarkably rich childhood, and then I was suddenly in Italy, where I had never seen a volcano. I had been to a volcano without understanding it in Hawaii when I was a child, but to actually see Mount Vesuvio was something quite different. And to be on a ship going across the Atlantic Ocean and seeing dolphins and whales was an extraordinary thing. I mean, that I had never seen anything bigger than a catfish that swam. And then here were these creatures that were just amazing. And I didn't understand how the boat stayed up, and was just an extraordinary time. And I was introduced to lots of things, introduced to a different kind of art, a different kind of labor involved in sculpting, for example. Going to the rock quarry where Michelangelo got his marble for La Pietà and for David from Carrara, just that sparkling white marble. Those were huge kind of lessons, and the people we encountered were very much like native people, very family-oriented, very clan-oriented. Especially in southern Italy and in Sicily. So I felt very much at home. The important thing for me, though, is I was not socialized to be oppressed. And when we returned to the United States, when I was a senior in high school, I had a really rude awakening, because I was suddenly back again with all these white yahoos in Oklahoma City, and surrounded by them, and not a lot of Native people except our family and a few families in the same neighborhood. But I was not cowed by them, and I didn't have to fight because I could usually out-talk them.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask this question. Let me segue. And you talked about the growing up and signs that talked about no dogs, Indians, or coloreds. Let's talk about, from your experience, the relationships, if there were, with Native Americans and African Americans. Because, I don't want to say it's a joke, but in some cases, it's said that a lot of African Americans, including myself, have Native American in them. From your perspective, talk about the relationships, both good and bad, that you've witnessed with Native Americans and African Americans.
Well, it depends on what the history is, as to what the relationship is. with the Muskogee Creeks, for example, the first people who were not Muskogee peoples they ran into, besides the Haudenosaunee, the Iroquois and the Cherokees and others in that what's now the Southeast United States, they were the Scots stonemasons who came over, and the Spaniards who came over toward the Gulf. And so there was that kind of interaction. The Scots stonemasons and the Muskogees had the same common enemy, the English, and the English had systematically killed the clan leaders of the Scots clans, and the Muskogees took the Scots into their clans. Their kinship and clan structure was so similar that they were able to do that. The Spaniards were very different culture, and there was not that kind of simpatico, and they did not get on. But they entered into a treaty. The Muskogee Creek Nations entered into a treaty with France and then with Spain and then with the United States. The first treaty with the United States, right after the United States, the last state, ratified the Constitution. So in 1790, there was the first treaty between the Muskogee Nations and the fledgling United States. So during this period, of course, the Europeans and the Euro-Americans had brought in Africans as slaves. And there were also African people who were not slaves, who either had run away or who had made their own way and who weren't part of the slave trade. So different parts of the Muskogee Confederacy reacted in different ways. Some had black slaves because they believed that in order to be civilized peoples, that they would behave like the U.S. people, like the Georgians and the Alabamans and the Mississippians and the Tennesseans behaved, and they would have slaves. Others did not, and they gave sanctuary. They gave safe harbor to runaways. So, and then took them into the Muskogee Confederacy, usually as part of the Seminoles, although sometimes they were sent for leadership training, as were young Muskogee people, youth, to the Miccosukees, because that means kind of leader people or chief people. Suki is people, and Miko is a chief or a leader. And they would do the training for leadership. So it's a very complex thing. And you could tell the same kind of, you could show the same kind of complexity with all the different nations in the Southeast. My mother's nation with Cheyennes, it's a different story. They didn't encounter white people until, they left the Northeast pursuant to an instruction that said to flee the coming of the white destruction. And they left. They picked up and left their home, and they were in the Great Lakes about the time that Columbus landed. So they lived under the protection of the Anishinaabe, and then they got that same instruction again, saying, flee the coming of the white destruction and follow the setting sun. So that's what took them out to the plains, just as you had Lewis and Clark going into the Great Lakes area. So they didn't really encounter these white people until the 1800s, and then the white men had black people with them, but they were their slaves at first, and so they were called by the Cheyennes the black white people.
The black white people. Can you expound a little bit more on that? The black white people.
Meaning that they were the same as the white people, only because they were either soldiering for them, killing for them, cooking for them, caring for their horses. They were the servants or the slaves or the junior soldiers. So they were always in a subservient position to the white people, and so they were called the black white people.
Black white people.
That, yeah.
And then later on, of course, I guess that's where the original term Buffalo Soldier came from. And from my research that some of the indigenous people saw the skin color and the hair texture, and they called them Buffalo Soldiers.
Yeah, the hair is what they refer to, the Lakotas especially, about the Buffalo Soldiers. And the Nez Perce described the white people as people with upside down faces, because they would say they had no hair on top, but they had all this hair on their chins. And so they said they were upside down faces. Mm. And I always thought that was interesting.
Yeah. Boy, I tell you, we are getting a lesson, and that's what this show is about, to be informative and in some cases even entertaining. Suzanne Harjo is in the Coach's Corner. And let's get to the meat of this interview. Since the 60s, you've been in the trenches getting sports teams to drop mascots that promote negative stereotypes. Talk about how that started. Talk about some of the victories that you've accomplished. And now, boy, we got to talk about the big victory that's on the horizon here in Washington, D.C. But let's start from the beginning in the 60s.
Well, I was in my senior year in high school in Oklahoma City, and a young man, but we thought he was kind of old, but he was closer to our age than not, and his name was Clyde Warrior, and he was a Ponca fancy dancer, and he was an organizer in Oklahoma. He was the head of Oklahoma Indian Youth Council, and he was organizing a national organization. There were founders all over the country, and he was one of them. He was the main one in Oklahoma, and so this organization, which still exists, was founded in 1963, called National Indian Youth Council. So in 1962, Clyde Warrior came to our class and our school and talked to us about voting rights and student rights. But he also talked to us about getting rid of the mascot Little Red at the University of Oklahoma. Now, Oklahoma City is just not even 30 miles from Norman, Oklahoma, and that's the home of the University of Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. So Little Red was very well known to all of us, who called him the dancing idiot. And he was a white guy who would be painted red, wearing supposedly Native style clothes, and doing some kind of weird movements which were supposed to be Native dancing. And we all thought he was a joke and didn't like it, but the crowds loved, the fans, OU fans just loved Little Red. So Clyde was telling us specifically, not just like Little Red or don't like him, call him an idiot or don't call him an idiot, but specifically what was wrong with that, that he was appropriating our persona, making fun of who we were, making a mockery of us, that we knew how to dance, we knew how to dress, we knew how all of the things he was pretending to be, and this, how wrong that was, that we were being used for the entertainment and the recreation of the people who were watching football. And there was no reason for it except that, you know, all these schools started out, they didn't have mascots. They started out with colors. So the University of Oklahoma was red and white. And they were big red. That's how why they're called red or big red. And so their mascot was a belittling version. It was Little Red to Big Red. So Big Red represented the white people, really, the Oklahomans, and Little Red represented the Indians. And so Clyde Warrior explained why this was unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And really recruited us, many of us, for his effort to get rid of Little Red. And then he said, and the worst one of all is right there in the nation's capital, and he named the Washington football team. And we knew that was a terrible word and that there was none worse than in the English language. But he was telling us the history of it and what was so awful about them invoking that heinous past where they skinned us and sold our skins and our private parts for bounty just as proof of Indian killed. And to invoke that kind of heinous history and violence that we never wanted to return to, and where many of our people were killed, that is just something that is so outrageous that you can't believe that people are actually doing it, but yet they are, and it was a multi-million dollar business.
And again, I don't want our listeners, I don't want this to fly by them, because you gave them the origin part of history. And I want you to repeat this in terms of the term red skin. And from my research, I learned that one of the origins of the term was when, as you stated, it was a scalp, a private part, they would point to it and say, hey, redskin, to prove that it was indeed a Native American. But can you really expound on the origin of that very despicable term, in my opinion?
Well, it was a practice. Some of the bounty proclamations, and these were, you know, by the fur trapping companies at first, and then they were by the colonies, the powerful colonies, and then they were by the states. So the state of California, the state of Nebraska, the state of Oklahoma, they were issuing bounty proclamations for dead Indians. And some of them just said Indians. So you could bring in anything, and that would stand as proof of a dead person. And whether that was their hair or whatever it was. But if they said, as Massachusetts did, that they wanted all the Penobscots killed, and they would pay a bounty for the Penobscot people, they had to bring in a certain thing that would identify them as Penobscots. And then there were other bounty proclamations that would specify a sliding scale, so much for a man, so much for a woman, so much for a boy, so much for a girl. Well, the only way you ascertain that is by the genitalia. And so they would scalp that. The genteel term was scalping, but it's all skinning. And the red skin referred to the native person's skin, but it also referred to the blood. So these were the bloody red skins. And they, this was a practice all over this country for a very long time. And in warfare in the late 1800s, early 1900s, people would go into war against native people and mutilate their bodies, and they call them trophies. And they would hang an arm, a native arm bone, up on their wall, or a skull, or private parts. It unimaginable things. And the people of my generation would see these in as a matter of course. You would go to a certain dentist or a certain doctor in South Dakota or North Dakota or Oklahoma, Nebraska, Kansas, New York, California, and you would see someone's body part on a wall or on a shelf. And that would, they'd say, well, that's a Pawnee trophy, or that's a Cheyenne trophy, that's a Cherokee trophy. And these are, and then the United States Army Surgeon General in the 1860s issued a proclamation to all, or direct order to all the Army officers to collect Indian crania, and they had to do certain specific things. They had to decapitate the body and measure the skull, weigh the brain, dip everything in lye, put a number on it, and ship it to Washington, D.C. And then the Smithsonian, when it got started, teamed up with the Army Medical Museum. And they used to advertise in the Rocky Mountain News and different newspapers for the ordinary citizen to go out and collect grave goods or bodies, or go into a cave and collect this, or go to this was stuff that these institutions were asking people to be grave robbers. And this was accepted practice, and it was called medicine. It was called science. This is very bizarre. And there are still collections of Indian skulls in Washington, D.C. So when you have all of these Indian heads and some, you know, Indian head highway, when you have Indian...
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that.
Right.
Yeah, talk about the origin of that, because...
You know, the Euro-Americans, the Europeans brought their traditions of cutting heads off and putting them on a stake and putting them along their castle walls or along their houses, their roads, to as a sign to the enemies, you better not mess with us because this is what happened to your predecessors. So this, when you hear something like Indian Head Highway, that's exactly what it means. It means that at one point there were many tall lances or stakes with Indian heads on them. So there's this really bizarre fetish about native heads that you see it on sports team logos, that it's a something I can't even, I take it very seriously, but I almost can't discuss it because it's so grisly and inhumane.
I would agree. I mean, anyone with a conscience or a heart would concur. Now, while we are in the business, rightfully so, of getting rid of a racist name, here in the same area, what can we do to get Indian Head Highway out? I mean,
yeah,
that to
me. It should
be
changed.
Excuse me?
Thank you.
I mean, that needs to be changed. And I'll tell you, for what it's worth, when I speak with the governor and or the lieutenant governor again, and I don't know the process to get it changed, but I will get the ball rolling.
Excellent.
To get this thing changed, because Indian Head Highway?
Really?
What else?
Exactly.
What else could it mean?
But exactly.
No, that you know what? We need to change that. And we need to change that ASAP. But now let's talk about your continuous battle in court, et cetera, protests with the Washington football team and the various owners being arrogant and saying, we're not changing the name. And Suzanne, even to the extent of running polls and telling the public that, you know, that the majority of the Native Americans look at it not in a negative sense or being derogatory, but with great pride. And I'm saying, you guys are fooling. Who's zooming who here?
Right, right. Well, they kept telling us that we were honored, that we were being honored. We would say, no, we're offended. No, you're honored. No, you're offended. No, back and forth, back and forth. And that really was our lawsuit. We're offended. You're honored. Shut up. They were so disrespectful to us, and they made us try to prove everything. Well, first, George Preston Marshall never would meet with any Native people who wanted the name changed. Edward Bennett Williams actually met with some Native people in the early 70s, but he did nothing, and no one else ever met with us. And then when I was running the National Congress of American Indians in the 80s, I tried to get meetings with Jack Kent Cook, who was the owner then, and he wouldn't even respond to a call or to a note or a letter. And then finally he answered us, but through a UPI reporter, saying something like, there's not a jot twiddle chance in hell that the name's going to be changed. It's a tradition, it's not offensive, and it would cost too much money. Well, none of those things were true. Not one. Well, it was a tradition, but so is hanging. It was a tradition, but there are all sorts of racist traditions, so it was one of those, a racist tradition. And was it offensive? Well, it wasn't offensive to him because he was a rich old white guy. It was offensive to us, and the people who get to articulate the nature of an offense and to say whether or not it's offensive are the people who are offended, not the offender.
That's right. And I've said that, and you know the history very proudly, that Ms. Kathy Hughes, who is the founder, CEO of Urban One / Radio One, but started off with WOL, 1450 AM. And in the 80s, Ms. Hughes banned the word. When I came on in 1992, I understood. She didn't have to twist my arm. I was behind her 100%. And I can proudly say, with the exception of a quote, I've never use the word. And now, and when I found out and did some research and saw you, I invited you on the show a number of times, and we thought we had a victory a few years ago with the patent, but what happened with that?
Well, we filed when Jack Kent Cook wouldn't meet with us, and when he answered us through the press, we were looking for a lawsuit. We were looking for a cause of action, and we didn't want to take a civil rights approach because we didn't think that would sway anyone. We wanted to take something that was about the money, not for us, because we weren't looking for any damages or any money of any kind. We were only looking for a name change, and we weren't even forcing that. Anyway, Steve Baird, a patent lawyer from Minneapolis, had seen on television a demonstration outside the stadium in his hometown where the Washington team played, and there was a demonstration against the Washington team and its name. And he tried to find people. He found me. He did research and saw that I was quoted a number of times on the issue. And so he contacted me and said, you know, I understand you looked at various forums and various causes of action, and what made you reject the U.S. Patent and Trademark Board and Section 2 of the Lanham Act as a cause of action? And I said, I have no idea what you just said. I don't know what you're talking about. And so he explained that Section 2 of the Lanham Act said that no material name, image, symbol could, or product could be could receive a trademark if it disparaged people. There were four prongs of a test, and you only needed one. You only needed to prove one. If it was disparaging, if it held people up to contempt, if it held people in ill repute, or if it was scandalous. And so we filed a lawsuit. He explained what all of that meant. I hired him as the lawyer for me, and then six people who I thought would be able to last in protracted litigation, and we went forth and filed on September 10, 1992. And I always like to say that's the last time when Steve Baird saw them saw the team in Minneapolis in 92 for the 91 season, that's the last time they were ever at a Super Bowl to this day. So 30 years, almost 30 years on, and they haven't been back, and people would like to say, oh, that's a Indian curse. There's no such thing as an Indian curse. Karma. That's karma.
Well, you know what it is? I don't think it's karma. I don't think it's a curse. Well, no. If it is a curse, you know what the curse is? Daniel Snyder, the owner. That's the curse.
There you go.
That's the curse right there. Now, what was your reaction when you started to get the news about the money people, FedEx, Nike, Pepsi, and others saying, hey, this name needs to change, and if it doesn't, we are taking our money out of the product? And connect that with the social injustice that we're witnessing throughout the country. That is, you know, as we talked about before the show, that is setting a storm of social change.
Well, yes. Thank you for asking that. We had worked, a lot of us began to work with the socially responsible investors about 15 years ago, and there was created an Indigenous Peoples Working Group, and then an Investors and Indigenous Peoples Working Group. And So we would write craft resolutions for shareholders of FedEx, of Bank of America, of PepsiCo, Nike, and so forth. And they would go to, the shareholders would go to shareholder meetings and try to get their issues on the floor and say, why are we supporting this? This is a racist name. And they were given the runaround. They were given the runaround for 10 years, fully 10 years. And then this last letter went, and Bank of America had an opportunity to not renew two contracts with the Washington franchise, and they did not do it. So we didn't even bother going back to Bank of America. But people who were the shareholders felt there was promise in FedEx, there was promise in Nike, and promise in PepsiCo. So a letter was written, they wrote, we wrote, a letter to the to them. And almost as soon as the letters landed, people were protesting in the streets in over 700 cities in the United States. And there, and change was in the air because of the horror brought to us by the Minneapolis police who murdered George Floyd.
Yeah.
In front of everyone, in front of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And those people in the boardrooms saw that. We saw that. Everyone saw it. And the people in the boardroom started saying, we've got to get ahead of this and start clearing out our portfolios, dealing with things that have been at our front door for a long time. So one of them was the name of the Washington team. And right away you had FedEx stepping forward, Fred Smith, again, who had given the shareholders the runaround for 10 years and then 5 years of meetings, all of a sudden was moved and got a new understanding of what could be done, and that they were the catalyst. They weren't reacting. They had to do the acting. And so calling on Daniel Snyder to change the name, organizing with his other 40% owners of the franchise to cash out and sell to others, maybe even to Native Nations. And then you had all these people, I mean, Target removing merchandise from the shelves and from their website, Nike and Walmart and Amazon.com. This is huge, what was happening. And then Daniel Snyder finally said, after several, almost a week of that, said, no mas.
Yeah, yeah. Now, there are other professional teams that have Native American nicknames and mascots. And from my perspective, some are more offensive than others. But certainly, as we talked about earlier, if you are offended, then I'm offended. So let's look at some of the others. The Atlanta Braves. Now, that chop, that's offensive. And that, you know, that, whoa, that's offensive. Okay. The term Braves, do you view that as offensive?
Gives rise to the racist instincts and practices of the people who are watching the games. And the people who are selling tickets play to those racist instincts.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm for getting rid of all of the so-called Native references, whether they're innocuous or not, whether they're a lesser offense or not. They're all a little racist, but a little racist is still racist. Mm-hmm. It can
Kansas
be a lot
City
racist or a little racist, but it's
Kansas
all
City Chiefs.
Racism.
Kansas City Chiefs?
Same thing. They
okay.
used to have, they used to name their end zone sacred ground.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, with graves being dug up all over the country and they're calling their and our sacred places destroyed and desecrated daily, and they're calling their end zone sacred ground and wearing all this war paint supposedly, and you know, enough is enough. You can't do an entire red face act and then say, oh, we didn't mean anything bad, we're just honoring you. It's no honor, and get rid of it all. A friend of mine who lives in Kansas City insists that they should be called the chefs and wear
well, that,
great
yeah.
big chef hats.
Yeah. Well, now, speaking of that, do you have a preference in terms of, okay, right now, thankfully, it's already been established that the Washington R's are no longer. The logo
right.
is no longer. So now
right.
we're looking at a new nickname, mascot, logo. Do you have a preference, or your thing is, hey, I don't care what you call them, just it can't be racist, it can't be a negative stereotype.
It can't offend any human beings, period.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And there are so many things. They could call themselves the monuments, the senators. They could call themselves all sorts of things. They don't have to rag on us or any other people. They can, I used to be partial because of the line. I used to be partial to the name Wild Hogs. I thought that was kind of a neat name.
Yeah,
but,
the hogs,
you know,
yeah.
It's sort of, that's really old school. And a lot
now,
of people don't even remember that one.
Mm-hmm. Now, the two names that I prefer, and I know a lot of people, the easy one would be the Warriors. Okay, but I'm looking at, if I were king for a day or had a magic wand and could wave it, to me, the perfect name would be the Red Tails.
Mm.
Okay, and that the origin of that are the Tuskegee Airmen.
Right.
And so that, or, you know, as you say, they could go to the Federals, which was a professional team years ago. They could they could adopt the XFL name, the Defenders. There's so many names, but you know what? I've never been a name person, a uniform person. Give me good players, a good coach, and
right.
and a lot of W's. You can call them whatever you want, as long
yeah,
as it's right. not offensive. But, you know, it's not about, look, the Green Bay Packers, you know, what's a Packer?
Right.
What is a Packer? You know, somebody who packs meat in the Midwest.
Yeah,
you know, but if
right.
you win, it's simply... doesn't matter. Now, let's look at the collegiate level where you've had some victories. You still have lots of victories to go, but let's look at St. John's, for example, and Syracuse
mm-hmm.
and some others that you've
right.
had some victories. Now, what about Florida State Seminoles?
Well, the lawyer has written, the Seminole lawyer for the Seminole tribe in Florida, and the Seminole Nation in Oklahoma does not agree with this, but the Seminole tribe in Oklahoma and the Seminole lawyer said that in the early 70s, they went to FSU, who was using the mascot, the name of the team, Sammy Seminole, and they said they didn't want to be identified with African Americans, and if they dropped Sammy, they could use Seminole. I was shocked when I learned that history from his own writing of it, and I just think that was unconscionable. But that's what they did, and that's the agreement they keep talking about that they have with the Seminoles. And what they did was FSU took out a copyright. They trademarked the name Seminole. So they own the name Seminole, which is so backward. It is just, it's a crazy world.
Now that goes against some of my research in terms of history, because I was taught that the of all the Native American tribes, that the Seminoles were the ones who had a close alliance with African Americans, and in a lot of cases, it was a sanctuary grounds for blacks and runaways at that point.
Well, yes, which is why it's so offensive that they took that position in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely. Because people ran away and knew that they could seek solace there, and with the Seminoles and with the Miccosukees and with Muscogee Nation, Confederacy nations and tribal towns all throughout what's now the Southeast United States.
And
it's terribly offensive.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. Looking at Syracuse, now Syracuse, initially they were known as the Orange Men. Now, I don't know what an Orange Men is. Now, some people would say, not me, I'm just repeating, some people would say that we got an Orange Man in 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Right, yeah, that's right.
But I'm not saying that.
Well, it was either a Scots or a Scots-Irish person, and that's who they were making fun of at that time. But they came up with the Saltine Warrior, and that was a hoax. There was printed in the school paper this article that said when excavating for a new building on the campus of Syracuse University, that they unearthed an Onondaga chief, and now he is our mascot called the Saltine Warrior because it's a salt area. Oh, God. Anyway, so that was that's the origin myth of the Saltine Warrior. And my friend Aaron Lyons, who is one of the chiefs at Onondaga, which is the firekeeper, the capital of the Iroquois Confederacy, the Haudenosaunee people, he was an All-American in lacrosse with Jim Brown, who was also an All-American in lacrosse.
That's right.
As well as the Jim Brown, who's famous as an All-American in other sports. And Syracuse is within the original territory of Onondaga, and it's just not very far from Onondaga. And they went to the chiefs and the clan mothers backed up the students at Syracuse University and said, enough with the Saltine Warrior, get rid of it. So they did, and they reverted back to just their color, which was orange. They were the color orange. And then that morphed into orange, the fruit. And now, I don't know what it is, but at least they're moving in a direction away from, you know, something that has an origin of having been removed from its own grave and made into a mascot. I mean, this is hideous stuff. At least they're getting in a more fun direction if they're calling your mascot the fruit orange.
Yeah. Well, look, we've got a few minutes left, but Let me ask this question. And again, I'm huge on imaging. And growing up, and you know, we're all in the same generation. We're baby boomers. And blacks were depicted as buffoons, shiftless, and lazy. The Native Americans were depicted as savages, you know, inhumane, etc. What can we do? And things have changed a little bit. But in terms of imaging, talk about that, not just in the sports arena, but in Hollywood, on the silver screen, and on television. Because, you know, growing up, I'm rooting for Gerald Custard. You know what? Come on. You know, I'm rooting for the Cavalry because I didn't know any better.
Well, even some Native people were rooting for the Cowboys because they got tired of losing all the time. You hear that a lot from people in our general generation. These depictions still continue, and then you have racists who bought up old movies and keep showing them, showing all this racist stuff, all the cowboys and Indians and cavalry and, you know, let's kill Indians, let's talk about them this way and that way, and all the jungle movies that depict African Americans and black people generally just horrible. These are horrible things. They're polluting our airways totally. So the newer generations are being exposed to this stuff without adequate contextualization. And we have lots and lots of people who are scholars who have contextualized them. And I think every time they show one of those movies, they ought to say, now here, young people, here's what you're looking at. When you see this, think this, understand, look for that, look for that. This is done as a deliberate put down of this people and this people and this people. And here's how they did it. Here's how they did it with lighting. Here's how they did it with movement. Here's how they did it with makeup. Here's how they did it with hair. Here's how they still do it on television, where it's only been in the past 10 to 20 years that there has been adequate training for people who do makeup for everyone going on shows who are people of color. Every bit of makeup used to be just makeup that was done for white people. But it's different for people of color. So the person of color on television, whether a guest or an anchor or a reporter, would look really odd and less attractive than the white person because the makeup was done for the white person and the lighting was done for the white person. And the background was done for the white person. So we have that is beginning to change because so many people of color are in broadcasting and know how to do this and know how to do makeup and know how to do what that means when you're sitting in front of a certain kind of image or not. So things are changing, but not fast enough. And we just have to really understand how powerful these negative images are and do everything we can to put up our best people who are really good at explaining how dastardly they are, this negative imaging, and so that the people are really educated as they're watching this dreck and they learn something from it. That is going on in schools. That's happening on campuses, and good. And right now, I mean, people have been waiting for all these statues to come down. Museums and cities and all sorts of repositories have said, we're going to do it. We're thinking about it. We're talking about it. We're having a focus group. We're having a thorough review. We're having a process. Just give us time. And everyone is in the street saying, time's up. I just saw a wonderful image of a Columbus statue in a lake saying, Columbus discovers lake.
and look, listen, you know, I think a lot of us now are aware that Christopher Columbus was nowhere near a hero. He shouldn't be honored in any place. Now, no offense to people Italian descent, but, you know, right is right, and he shouldn't be honored. But having said that, I'm personally not in favor of vigilantism and just moving statues and destroying statues like that, because as a wise person once told me years ago, that the same things will make you laugh or make you cry, meaning that if you have one group that'll take down a statue, and you'll say, okay, well deserved. But then it may be another group to take down a statue that, you know, someone that you admire. So there's a right way and a wrong way to do things. Last two questions, and these are two very important
questions.
Could
I just say something about
that? Sure, absolutely.
Okay. The American Museum of Natural History in New York had that dreadful statue of Teddy Roosevelt on his high, high horse within this white supremacy stance with a black man on one side of his horse and an Indian man, a native man on the other side on foot with a slightly bowed posture. Mm. Now, that was complained about. That was focus group that was talked about moving. People in the street clear that something was going to be done one way or the other, and some people got enthusiastic and did it one way. The museum, the American Museum of Natural History, went to the city of New York and said, between us, we've got to move the statue of Teddy Roosevelt because he's next. And they moved it. Mm-hmm. And they're going to recontextualize the statue inside the museum, do an exhibit there, have it work with people who are African American, work with people who are Native American, work with people who know that era, who know how much land Teddy Roosevelt stole from Native people. In order to make these glorious parks, but at what cost, to bring out the kind of history that made people upset about that statue. And I want them preserved, too, for that purpose. And they're our best evidence of what's been wrong in the past and what we want to avoid in the future. So I'm with you on that. But I don't fault the people who have gotten upset about no one doing anything after decades of saying they will.
Yeah, and the perfect example, folks removed the statue of Columbus in Baltimore, but then I think where was it, in New York, Buffalo, I think someone defamed a statue of Frederick Douglass. And so that's what I'm saying.
Wow.
We've got about 5 minutes left, but I've got a big question for you. Want to get your thoughts. Right now, one of the big topics, or, you know, in the last 10 years, 20 years, it's been discussed. But with the climate now, this is a perfect time to talk about reparations. And for 3 minutes or so, if you know how you can capsule, talk about if there have been reparations for Native Americans, And do you foresee reparations on the horizon for African Americans, and in what form?
Well, there have never been reparations for Native Americans. There have, and the treaties, which make certain provisions in perpetuity in exchange for the land in perpetuity, have not been lived up to, and those promises have been broken for the most part, although the land hasn't been given back. So we want the United States and its citizenry to live up to the treaties that exist. And we want to talk about additional things to help make up that things that have happened to us in the meantime, in health, in education, and so forth. For African Americans, I think the time is long past for reparations. The country simply has to come to grips with the genocide it committed against Native Americans, against African Americans, the land it stole from us, from Native peoples, the slavery that it engaged in, primarily of African Americans, but also Native Americans, Chinese Americans, Mexican Americans, all sorts of people were enslaved. And I think we have to look at reparations for that as well, because that is a huge one. This country was built on Native land and on the backs of people of color, mm-hmm. who were considered property of the white people.
Mm-hmm. So reparations in what form, though? That's
exactly that is going to take a generation.
Yeah.
It'll take a generation.
Yeah.
For it, whatever it turns out to be.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's where you are in life. I mean, reparations could be land. Reparations could be tax exempt. It could be a check. It could be a lot of things. But I concur. It's long overdue, and some form of reparation needs to be in place. We've got about 30, 40 seconds. I'm going to give you the floor. I call it words of wisdom, parting shots. Hey, use them as you see them.
Oh, thank you so much. I so appreciate having this conversation with you. It's been too long, and it's a good time to have it because it's a hopeful time, and we're really on the edge of mighty change in the country and the world. And I think a lot of things that have been holding peoples back for a long time are going to suddenly find a way to be dealt with differently. One thing that the Buddhists say is that you have to make an opening in a room so evil can escape. And I like that concept of evil wants to go someplace. It wants to leave, but sometimes it gets trapped. And you have to remember to show it the way out. And I think that's what this time of change is doing. It's liberating people from the burden, their burden of racism that they're carrying around. It's hurting us, but it's also hurting them. And I think it's going to be a more graceful world once this change settles down. But it's in the changing and the settling down that we're going to have a tumultuous time.
Well, if there were more people in the world like Suzanne Harjo, it would be a great place. I really respect you. I admire you. And my platform is always open for you. And congratulations on a big, big victory of so many years, as I've stated, being in the trenches to get something reversed. And now it's done. No more Washington R's. And the next thing, as I said, and I may be one of the first to get on this, I don't care, but I'm going to use this platform and my other radio shows. Now let's look at Indian Head Highway, because
yep.
if you're not offended by
Absolutely.
That, then you're not offended.
That's
thank
right.
you so thank you so much. I appreciate
thank you,
this visit.
Coach.
Yeah. And folks can contact you by?
The Morningstar Institute and Suzanne Harjo at mac.com.
Okay. Thank you, Suzanne Harjo. And folks, I know you enjoyed it. It was so informative. And that's what we do here on In and Out of Sports in the Coach's Corner. Yeah, we'll bring you the legends of sports and the various games, but we'll also inform you and give you information that you can't necessarily read, but we give it to you straight from the individuals that are in the trenches. And I want to thank our sponsors, Horton's Funeral Service. They're located at 600 Kennedy Street, Northwest Washington, D.C. They're simply the best in providing service with great dignity at affordable rates. 202-829-9000. And if you're in need of any dental care, come on now. You got to keep that smile looking good. You got to have those chops so you can eat the steak and the pork chops or whatever you eat. Dr. Edward T. Buford, 202-667-8818, U Street, right next to Ben's Chili Bowl. And folks, always go to the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com. Again, the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com. Read the wonderful stories and interviews by my producer, Rick Hampton Sr., and all of the shows past and this show today. Well, thank you for joining us, and hey, tune in Monday. Next week we will have more exciting guests, legends, etc. I'll keep you posted. And this Sunday, In and Out of Sports, WOL, DCNews.com, WOL, DCNews.com, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. But until then, make good decisions, because life is hard, but it's even harder when you're stupid. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you next time.
You'll listen to a 30-second